Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How has the balance of power shifted from east to west over the course of human history? And do those fluctuations favor whichever hemisphere is somehow most deserving of hegemony? In search of answers to those questions, my guest today began with our ancient past, when our hunting and gathering ancestors first endeavored to stay in one place and raise their own crops and animals, then considered the rise of cities, armies, and technologies into the present day. And he is convinced that the current dominance of the West is less about any special intelligence or social values than about quite literally finding ourselves in the right place at the right time. Ian Morris is Jean and Rebecca Willard Professor in Classics and History at Stanford University. His book, now available in paperback, is called Why the West Rules for Now, The Patterns of History and What They Reveal About the Future. Ian, welcome to Think.
Hi, thanks for having me on the show.
First of all, where is the dividing line for purposes of this discussion between East and West?
Yeah, well, good question to start with, because often the answers people give to a question like why is the West dominant, they often come down really to how you choose to define things like West and East or North and South. And what people often do is say, you know, we live in the West, we think of ourselves as being defined by democracy, freedom, Christianity, all kinds of values that we tend to think of the West as having. And we'll then look back into the past to say, where do I first start to see these particular values appearing? And I think what that does, when you look at history that way, it sort of foreshortens the whole thing and traps you into just talking about very recent developments. Mm-hmm. So what I did, I tried to start looking at the problem kind of from the other end and saying, at what point in history do we first begin to see distinctive ways of life emerging around the world? And for that, you have to go back a very long way to the to the end of the Ice Age, when the world starts warming up and farming begins to be possible. And then there's just a few places around the world where we see farming being independently invented. And out of these original core areas, we see gradually the development of all of the great civilizations in the world today, which spread out from these initial areas of farming. And the earliest of all of these areas was in what we now would call Southwest Asia. And this is where the world's first farming societies appeared, and farming then expanded out from there, kind of across Europe, into Central Asia, into Egypt. And the societies I call Western societies, are the ones that have developed from this westernmost core of where farming developed about 10,000 years ago. And the societies I call Eastern are the ones that developed out of the easternmost core at the other end of Eurasia over the centuries.
And in both of these places, as agriculture was developing, it wasn't necessarily a factor of people being especially clever. It was that they happened to have the good fortune of finding themselves in a place where the ecosystem included plants and animals that lent themselves to early domestication.
Right, yeah, exactly. People, they've got kind of the same sets of problems all over the world. When times are good and there's more food out there for hunters and gatherers to collect, the population starts to grow. And then after a while, you know, there's more mouths to feed, you get more pressure on the food resources again. And so, you know, a number of things can happen. People can start starving, or people can break up into smaller bands, or people can tinker around with the food supply and try to get more food out of it. And this, looks from the archaeology like this is going on all over the world. But in some places in the world, there are the wild ancestors of modern wheat and barley, or modern cattle and sheep. And when people start messing around with these plants and animals, without realizing what they're doing, they start changing their genomes, start changing their genetic structures, and turning them into animals and plants that can be used much more effectively by humans. Now, if you lived in Siberia, this couldn't happen. I mean, not because people in Siberia were lazier or anything than people in Southwest Asia, but the wild ancestors simply didn't exist there. There was nothing that you could domesticate. And so what happens, starting about 10,000 years ago, is that in all the places in the world where there are plants and animals that can be domesticated, people start domesticating them. And so, yeah, like you say, it's not that people at the beginnings of Western society were any smarter or more energetic than anybody else. It's just that they were in the right place at the right time.
So as agriculture emerges, larger groups of people can live together in the same place. And when there are lots of people together, they learn from one another, and that spurs innovation.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, if like say if you're forming a club or an organization or something, if there's just two or three of you, you don't particularly need any rules to manage what you're doing. But if it goes up to 20 or 30 people, you need more, a little bit more organization. You have 200 or 300 people, you start needing a lot of organization. You're going to have a president of the society or whatever. Similar sort of things happen as the population grows thousands of years ago when farming kicks in, and the number of people crowded into the same space just grows and grows. And people either figure out ways of organizing themselves in more complex societies, or they have to start splitting up and spreading out. And it looks like both of these things are going on at once. So the area occupied by farmers gets bigger and bigger, and the complexity of the societies within these areas gets higher and higher as well.
And so as people decide, some of those people decide they want to go elsewhere, they take what they have learned in the places where farming already exists.
Yeah, exactly. And this is where things start to get kind of weird and interesting. That people are moving out of these original farming areas and moving into new places. As they do so, they discover that the kind of skills and techniques that worked just great back home don't necessarily work very well in the new places. Like, say, you know, people move from the original homeland of farming in Southwest Asia up in a sort of hilly area, what's roughly now the borderlands of Iran, Iraq, Turkey, Syria, where early farming is fed mostly by the rainfall. They move down into places like modern Iraq, and they find that down there, that this way of being a farmer and relying on the normal rainfall, this just doesn't work anymore. And in order to make farming work at all, they have to develop much more complex societies that are able to channel the waters of the Tigris and the Euphrates to irrigate their fields, and then also allows them to move goods around between settlements. And by the time they've figured out how to make farming work, they realize they've actually discovered a way to make it far more productive than it ever was in the past. So you get this funny thing happening as these core areas expand, that on the frontiers, people are constantly innovating and discovering new ways to do things, which often turn out to be better than the old ways of doing things.
So initially, just proximity to a good, reliable source of fresh water for irrigation spurred a great deal of development. As time went on, it really mattered that people had access to trade routes so that they could exchange not only goods, but also ideas.
Yeah. What I realized as I was writing this book, I started off with this rather simple idea that geography was driving social development. Mm-hmm. Geography determined how a society would develop. But then I realized as I got further into it that the geography is like a two-way street. And you know, on the one hand, geography certainly does determine how the societies develop. But at the same time, the ways the societies develop determine what the geography means. So you know, right after the end of the Ice Age, the most important thing was to live in one of these areas where the wild ancestors of domesticable plants and animals had already evolved, so you got something to work with. Then over the next few thousand years, it turns out that now, as the societies get more complex and sophisticated, having access to great rivers becomes the most important thing. And as you say, you can move your goods around, you can irrigate your fields, all kinds of stuff becomes possible. A few more thousand years go by, and it starts to turn out that having access to an entire sea is even better than having access to great rivers. So like in the western part of the old world, the great civilizations that had arisen in Egypt and Mesopotamia, these start to get eclipsed by the Greeks and Romans in the first millennium BC, because they've got an entire sea at their disposal. They can ship goods around the Mediterranean. And the Mediterranean becomes kind of a superhighway in this period.
And it's also going to be important, once people are moving around from place to place, to be able to defend your own territory from encroachers.
Yes, all kinds of things start happening together. As the societies get bigger and more complex, they're extracting more energy from the world and processing it in more efficient ways. And the scale of the struggles between them, though, become more and more intense. And so a big part of social development, although it's not a part that we like to dwell on all that much, but a big part of it is the war-making capacity and the ability to defend what you've already got against somebody else. Or sometimes you see, you know, the people next to us have got all this stuff. We think we should have that stuff instead. So people will go out and try to seize things from their neighbors.
So we know a lot, having studied Western history, mostly in this country, about, you know, the great Roman Empire, and we know about the Greeks. Why did all of that give way to the Dark Ages in Europe by, what, about the 5th century AD?
Yeah. There's this constant back and forth going on between the geography is driving up social development as people adapt themselves to the world they live in, and at the same time, the process of adapting changes what the geography means. You know, the rivers and then the seas become more and more important. And by about the sort of switch from BC to AD, so somewhere around that period, another surprising thing starts to happen. You're getting all these great big empires developing, the Roman Empire and the Mediterranean, of course, the Mauryan Empire in India, the Han Dynasty in China, a bunch of other empires too. They basically run along a band of latitudes from the Mediterranean to China, which are, at that level of development, that's the sort of place that an empire can really flourish. And along the northern edge of these empires, there are the grasslands of the steppes, which run all the way from China out to Hungary in the west. And this is a pretty unwelcoming area for humans. And grass can grow there, but not really much else can grow there. And the only way humans manage to survive on the steppes is by the fact that other animals can eat the grass. So cattle, horses can eat the grass. People can then eat the cattle and horses. And as far as we can tell, horses originally get domesticated as a food supply, first of all, not for transport. But for thousands of years, the steppes are this backward, not very important periphery to the great empires. But then by about the BC-AD transition point, the horses have gotten so big out on the steppes that people can now ride around on these horses and can move very, very quickly along the steppes. People on the steppes discover they can start raiding the big settled societies of the empires and taking stuff away from them. And the steppes abruptly change their meaning. Once again, the geography changes its meaning. And this time when that happens, it has enormous consequences. You get huge movements of people back and forth along the steppes, the famous barbarian invasions into the Roman Empire and into Han China. They also start spreading diseases along the steppes. Mm. And like disease pools that had been completely separate, like they say in China and Rome, by about the 2nd century AD, these are starting to merge together and completely new diseases are appearing, which nobody has ever seen before, wiping out maybe as much as a third of the population across these empires. And this starts to make the empires come to pieces. And so this is another thing that we see constantly going on in the story, that sometimes the ways that geography changes its meanings has really disastrous results. And by about the 5th century, yeah, the Roman Empire in the West has come to pieces completely. The Han Dynasty in China has collapsed. Everything has begun to change.
Meanwhile, China was able to sort of reinvigorate itself in the 6th century. What put it in a good position to do that?
Yeah, once again, geography seems to be kind of the bottom line in this story. There's, you know, lots and lots of details of things going on, kings and battles and wars and so on. At the two ends of Eurasia, like the European end and the Chinese end, they have very different consequences. And in Europe, people are trying to put empires back together again in the 6th century, but it never works out. They always fail, get defeated, things break down again. The Arabs invade in the 7th century. They, too, try to create a great empire, which rapidly breaks down into smaller kingdoms. In China, though, they do succeed in putting the empires back together. And it seems to be driven mostly by the fact that in China, you've got this great new fertile food supply developing down in the Yangtze River area in southern China, which is something that isn't really happening so much in other parts of the world. They just got a different geographical arrangement. The Chinese start being able to tap into enormous amounts of food, of new strains of rice being grown in the Yangtze Delta, and are able to use that to feed the armies that reunite the empire. And the result of this is that after thousands of years when the highest levels of social development have always been in the western end of Eurasia, by about the year 500 or so, Eastern Asia is starting to catch up and overtake the West.
Ian Morris is my guest. His new book is called Why the West Rules for Now. We'll be back in just a minute.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a graduate education flexible enough to allow you to explore what matters most to you. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Jean and Rebecca Willard, professor in classics and history at Stanford University, Ian Morris. His book is called Why the West Rules for Now, The Patterns of History and What They Reveal About the Future. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. We have an email here, Ian, from Sean in Coppell, who says, I'd be very interested in Professor Morris's opinion on the books of Jared Diamond, who of course wrote Guns, Germs, and Steel, and any distinctions he might make between his own scholarship and that of Mr. Diamond.
Well, great question. Yeah, I'm a huge fan of Jared Diamond's work. I think he was one of the first people who really put geography back in the mix for trying to understand long-term human history. And I guess I would say that what I'm doing differs little bit from what he did in Guns, Germs, and Steel is that he made the case probably more clearly than anybody had done before about how geography drives how society develops and why the agricultural revolution at the end of the Ice Age had such a big influence on the distribution of power and wealth around the world. But I think what he then did after talking about the end of the Ice Age, he kind of leapt forward rather to what's going on in the contemporary world. And I think the result of that, by not going into very much detail about what happened in the 5,000, 10,000 years in between, was that he didn't really stress the other side of the equation, which is that geography drives how societies develop, but at the same time, the way society develops changes what the geography means. And this is why history has turned out to be such a complicated thing, I think. That, you know, you can say history is driven by geography, right? It's one-word answer. But then you start looking at what actually happens, and of course there's all this messy stuff going on all the time. And I think to explain the history properly, you've got to burrow into that messy stuff, which is what I try to do in my book, and look at all the events that have filled the last 5,000 or 10,000 years. And every time you're dealing with a situation where it looks like, in fact, maybe the decisions of some great man really did change history, or maybe some accident changed the way everything turned out, I think you need to be able to look at these episodes and explain properly why it is that, in fact, it was the deeper forces of geography that really were driving the way things turn out. So I guess the big difference, I'd say, between the two books is that mine puts a lot more emphasis on the way that changes within the societies transform what the geography means than Professor Diamond did. But that said, I'm still a huge fan of his books. I think Guns, Germs, and Steel is one of the most important books of the last 20 years.
So, for example, when you talk about humankind changing what geography means, you have the Western Europe and the British Isles in particular, which for a long time were just this backwater. They were far away from the centers of everything important. But suddenly, when they had access to better naval technology, they're in the ideal location to go and explore the New World.
Yeah. I mean, Britain, it's, you know, it's a cold, miserable place. I grew up there, so I know it very personally. But, yeah, for, you know, thousands of years, being stuck out into the North Atlantic, this puts you really, this is the back of beyond. And you're a very long way from all the great centers of action. And this changed really abruptly about 500-600 years ago. And it was driven, paradoxically, driven very much by stuff that was happening at the other end of Eurasia. This is a golden age of Chinese culture and civilization 500 or 600 years ago. And all this great literature being produced, lots of new inventions being made. And the Chinese are the people who pioneer a whole bunch of new seafaring technologies, especially modern kinds of compass are invented there, better ways to steer ships. And these ideas spread very quickly and get picked up by all kinds of other people. And within a couple of centuries, the new ways of seafaring have made their way all the way to Western Europe. And when the Western Europeans get a hold of them, though, they have a very different impact in Western Europe than what they're having out in East Asia. Because the Atlantic Ocean, of course, is about 3,000 miles across. The Pacific Ocean is, with the winds and tides you've got to follow with these wooden sailing ships, and the Pacific Ocean is going to be about a 7,000 or 8,000-mile sail to get across. And the situation is a little bit like what happened at the end of the Ice Age, when everybody's tinkering around with food supply, and it's in the places that have most domesticable plants and animals. That's where people figure out first how to domesticate the plants and animals. So I think it's a little bit similar 500 years ago, when the Europeans are simply much closer to the Americas than anybody in East Asia. So not surprisingly, once the new kinds of societies are developing with the technology that cross the oceans, the Europeans are the first ones to do this. And I suggest in the book that what happens is that once again, changes in social development to change the meaning of geography. And the Atlantic now goes, like the steppes did centuries before, it's transformed from being a barrier around the big civilizations in the world into a new kind of superhighway. And the Europeans are able to start zipping around the Atlantic Ocean. And that, I think, that's really what drives European development up so fast in the last few centuries.
Because it's not that the Chinese weren't able to get around. In fact, I'm ashamed to say I didn't know very much at all about Zhang He before having read this book, but what a fascinating character.
Yes. Yeah, he's one of the big men in the story in every sort of way. According to the Chinese stories, the man was about 8 feet tall, an enormous guy. But this is an admiral that the Spanish recruits around about the year 1400, and he's a eunuch slave admiral. initially. He's brought into the Chinese Navy by the Emperor to lead fleets sailing out all over the Indian Ocean. And he's able to take these Chinese fleets all the way to the east coast of Africa, possibly down into Australia. Some people even think he did cross the Pacific Ocean and came to the west coast of the U.S., well, what's now the U.S. And he, people will sometimes say, well, you know, if Zheng He had been able to continue these voyages, the whole of history would have had a very different shape, because you know, when Cortez crosses the Atlantic, instead of overthrowing the Aztecs, when he got to Mexico, what he would have found was, of course, a Chinese governor already in place there. If the Chinese had continued these voyages that began about a century before Columbus. So I end up spending quite a bit of time in the book looking at this episode and saying, well, you know, why didn't the Chinese cross the Pacific Ocean? And I think the answer is once again driven by the geography, that it is just such a long way across the Pacific Ocean that eventually I'm sure the Chinese would have crossed the Pacific and would have colonized the Americas. But it was just so much easier for Europeans to do this because the distances were so much smaller.
And they could make it profitable as well.
Yes, yes. I mean, eventually sailing across the Pacific, of course, does become very profitable. Mm-hmm. California, where I live, wouldn't be what it is if crossing the Pacific were not now profitable. But back in the 17th, 18th, even the 19th century, the Pacific, it's just too big. It's very hard to generate profits by trading across the Pacific Ocean. Whereas the Atlantic, of course, is getting shrunk smaller and smaller as all these new technologies come online and the wealth it produces gets bigger and bigger.
Ian Morris is my guest. His new book is called Why the West Rules for Now, The Patterns of History and What They Reveal About the Future. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's go on the phones now and speak with Gene in Dallas. Hi, Gene.
Hello there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just would like the professor to speak plainly what is considered East and what is considered West.
Yeah, very good question. Yeah, I mean, in my book, I think that one of the big problems in arguing about this question has been sort of confusion and disagreement among specialists over what they mean by these terms, which often leads them to just be talking past each other a lot of the time and disagreeing over nothing very important. So I decided in my book that the best way to make sense out of this question was to start by going back in history to the point when you can first begin to see really distinctive ways of life appearing in the world, which is really, I think, about 10,000 years ago, at the end of the Ice Age, when the first farming societies begin to emerge. And the earliest ones in the world are toward the western end of Eurasia, in what we now think of as Southwest Asia. And these societies develop out of there, spread out across the Mediterranean basin and ultimately across Europe, off into Central Asia. And so the societies I call Western in my book are the ones that have developed in various ways out of that initial westernmost core. And I compare these with the Eastern societies that developed out of the easternmost core in the Old World in what's now China. And defining things in this way, I think, it has a number of consequences, one of which is that, of course, nowadays people will often say, often think of the West as basically non-Muslim societies at the western end of Eurasia and their colonies they founded overseas as the West continued expanding. And we'll tend to think of Muslims as people who are non-Western. I think if we think about the West in the kind of way I'm suggesting in this book, then the distinction between the Muslim world and the Christian world, this is much more a distinction within the Western world, which is certainly the way people thought about it when the Arabs initially started coming into Europe. The Arabs presented themselves as being people who'd come to complete the messages in the Jewish and Christian religious traditions, not as a kind of an alternative to them, but to the last word in this tradition. So I think looking at it in this way, it allows us to get a much bigger sense of what's going on. And I think it does change the way we look at the world.
Back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. This time we speak with Mia in Irving. Hello, Mia.
Hi, this is Mia. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you.
It's funny that he just spoke of what he said, because I was going to comment about how when they ask how the civilizations came to an end or how Rome came to an end, whenever the great societies are mentioned, they usually skip over the Islamic societies as a whole, but it was also comprised of not just Arabs, it was also comprised of Africans at the time, the Coptic, the people who were Christians in Egypt who became Muslim, and now we come to know as being Arab because they were so intermingled and intermarried and things like that. And it was a great society in its own right, in its own place, and so many times we get here in the West, it's just totally skipped over as if a part of history that never existed, you know. So I just wanted to make that comment, and I'm glad that he actually said what he said before then, and just I'll take my comment off there.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I think that's this is very true, that, like you say, the Muslim world is often just allowed to drop out of these stories. And for centuries and centuries, after the Arabs move into the Mediterranean basin there, they take over what used to be the Byzantine Empire there, what used to be the Persian Empire. And for centuries and centuries, the parts of the Western world that are most developed are the Muslim parts. And you might even say that the Muslim world really is the core of the West for many centuries. And the Christian part, for a long time, is really just this periphery on this richer Muslim core. But, I mean, what you're saying about Africa, I think, is also very interesting and important. Because Africa, of course, we tend to see mostly on the news these days, and you hear these horror stories about terrible things going on in Africa. And it's easy to get this very negative sense about what's happening in Africa, which, of course, is a sense that was very popular back in the heyday of European imperialism in the 19th and early 20th centuries. And a lot of Europeans, and then Americans too, reached the conclusion that there's something wrong with Africa. They can't develop civilizations as clever and sophisticated as Europeans can. And I think we can now see just how completely wrong that vision was. Africa below the Sahara, I mean, it's one of the parts of the world where there just weren't that many plants and animals that could easily be domesticated. There were some. So eventually you do start to get domestication of sorghum and millet and all kinds of other crops and animals in Africa. But it starts much later than it had started up in Southwest Asia. And my guess would be if somebody had been able to come to Earth and build a wall around Africa, which I realize is kind of an unlikely thing to suggest, but if they had, and built a wall around Africa that kept the rest of the world out, that left to its own devices, Africa would have developed in just the same way as we see with the other big complex civilizations of the ancient world. They would have had their own cities and states and empires. And Africa clearly does start off down this path, but just starts much later than the Europeans and Southwest Asians did. And because nobody ever did build a wall around Africa, what happens, of course, is that Africa gets drawn into the empire centered in other parts of the world. And for many, many centuries, the coasts of Africa have been explored and colonized by outsiders. Then the 19th century, the interior does too. So I suspect that if there'd been something that stopped that from happening, Africa would have developed in much the same way that Europe ultimately develops. But of course, that isn't how the reality turned out.
What about the Americas, Ian? We know that the Aztecs and the Maya had agriculture. They had these very complex societies. What combination of geography and human action caused them not to be in a place to go and try and colonize Europe or Asia?
Yeah. I think once again, probably the answer here is this whole thing about when the processes of domestication and farming and building cities, when these things get started. Because it's basically a couple of thousand years later in the Americas than back in Southwest Asia. And in Mexico, particularly in Oaxaca, and then also in the Andes Mountains in what's now Peru, you get agriculture developing independently in these places. The societies that come out of them generally seem to be developing in roughly the same kind of way as societies are done back in Mesopotamia or China, but just running on a slightly later schedule, basically. They got started down this path later because of where the plants and animals were. So when Columbus shows up in 1492, he comes into this world that in some ways, you know, it's a bit like Europe or Asia had been 2,000 or 3,000 years earlier. I mean, these are not exact, you know, it's not an exact timetable. It doesn't match up exactly. But in some ways, it's almost like a time machine when he crosses the Atlantic Ocean. And he comes into societies which are very complex and very sophisticated. They've got their own literary traditions, all kinds of things going on. But when they're confronted by the weapons and the organization that the Europeans bring, and particularly by the germs the Europeans bring. And Europeans have been interacting with farm animals and developing all kinds of nasty bugs and sharing these nasty bugs across Eurasia, and they're mixing them with Chinese nasty bugs and Indian nasty bugs. They bring all this stuff over to the New World. And the societies in the New World are just not in a position to stand up to this onslaught, you know, what the Europeans have been brewing up for a couple of thousand years longer than has been brewing up in the New World. So we get this dramatic collapse of the native complex societies. One of the things I learned writing this book was how often disease is in the driving seat in making these events play out. And so in the New World, of course, the diseases, we don't know exactly how many people they kill, but it's probably somewhere between 75% and 90% of the native population gets wiped out by disease in the first, say, 150 years after Columbus arrives. So, yeah, very dramatic story.
Ian Morris is with us. He's professor in classics and history at Stanford University. His book, available now in paperback, is called Why the West Rules for Now, The Patterns of History and What They Reveal About the Future. We will talk about the future after the break. Also take more of your calls at 1-800-933-5372. Additionally, you can reach us via email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Ian Morris, who is Jean and Rebecca Willard Professor in Classics and History at Stanford and author of the book Why the West Rules for Now, The Patterns of History and What They Reveal About the Future. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Ian, it feels very wrong to have to skip over hundreds of years of the Industrial Revolution and things like that, but I do want to get to the future. Does geography still matter, given that we are living in an almost entirely globalized world?
Yeah, I think the last 100 years or so is where we see development changing the meaning of geography faster than ever before. And in some ways, you can say that geography may be changing its meaning so fast that it doesn't really mean anything much anymore. And so many of us now spend such a big slice of our lives in a digital world where space and distance just don't really mean very much. But having said that, I think pretty obviously we're not yet in a world where space has lost its meaning altogether. And if you need to get anywhere, like if I wanted to get from where I am in California out to Dallas, I would have to jump on a plane and sit for many uncomfortable hours in an airplane at an airport at either end. And we haven't made these things disappear. disappear altogether. And where you're born in the world still makes a huge difference to what your life is going to be like.
You write in the book about something called the Index of Social Development. Talk about what it measures and where we are on that index today.
Yeah, this was an effort I was making to try to get everybody arguing over the place of the West in the world, to try to get them all kind of looking at the same set of things. Because, mm-hmm. I said before in our conversation, one of the big difficulties has been that people look at the West and imagine totally different things. They're looking at different parts of the world and thinking about what it means to be Western in completely different ways. So it seemed to me that the best way to move forward was to get something a bit more, a bit easier to grab a hold of and compare through time and space. And so I came up with this index, which was a way of measuring, basically measuring society's abilities to get things done in the world, how they're able to harness energy from the world and use it to various ends, and the sort of information technologies they develop to retain and to spread information, and the level of organization they've got to get things done. And this, it's a numerical index, which I take back all the way to the end of the Ice Age, using archaeological evidence and written evidence as well. And this then allows you to compare the societies in the different parts of the world and see just which parts of the world are the most developed at different points. And it's measured on a scale from 0 to 1,000 points. And 1,000 points was the highest score that it was theoretically possible for society to get in the year 2000, which is when I'm just as a nice round number, kind of cut off my story in the year 2000.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the highest score in the world at that point was the Western score, about 906 points, which is hugely higher than where humans were at the end of the Ice Age, which was about 4 points. A dramatic transformation in what societies have been like.
And we are headed for, you think, a century from now, a quadrupling of that score?
Well, yeah, this is one of the sort of entertaining things that having a numerical index like this allows you to do. That if you think you've figured out what the shape of social development over history has been, you can then take that shape and project it forward. And say, if we assume that things would, say, just carry on the same as they've been carrying on, what's going to happen next? So at the end of the book, I take the rates of change we see in East and West during the last 100 years and say, let's just project forward the same rates of change across the next 100 years, which had some pretty interesting results. One of them was that the Eastern line catches up with the Western. The gap between East and West currently is bigger than it's ever been in history. But the Eastern line is accelerating faster than the Western line at the moment. So one prediction of the book is that if nothing else in the world changed, then Eastern social development would catch up with Western social development in about 100 years' time, maybe a little sooner than that, nearly 100 years' time. Another interesting thing that came out of this was saying, well, what will be the level, what will the scores look like at the point that that happens? And that was pretty remarkable. If development keeps accelerating at the rate it did in the 20th century, by the end of the 21st century, it's going to be up around 5,000 points.
Hmm.
And it had increased by about 900 points, and that got us all the way from Stone Age cavemen painting on the walls of their caves or whatever at the end of the Ice Age, all the way to call-in talk shows on NPR. That's 900 points gets you.
We're at the top. We're at the apex of
that's right,
where we are now.
And everything. But then another 4,000 points, which is what the index predicts would happen in the 21st century. That implies four times as much change in the next 100 years as we've seen in the whole 14,000 years since the Ice Age started wrapping up, which is pretty remarkable. And that pushed me then to a third question we might draw out of this projection exercise is, well, okay, if we don't think that that's going to happen, if we don't think we're entering a science fiction age when just the world is going to change so much it'll be unrecognizable, what might happen that could prevent us from getting to 5,000 points? And so these are the problems I try to tackle at the end of the book. What might the world look like if we go to 5,000 points? What could happen to stop that from coming about?
And the reality is a lot could go wrong.
Yes, it certainly could, yeah. One of the alarming things, I think, is that when you look back through history, there's been several periods where social development has gone up very quickly. But then quite often it stagnates and starts to fall again, and societies will go into what historians often call dark ages and disastrous collapses. And whenever this has happened, we see the same five factors cropping up every time. One of them is massive migration on a scale that the society simply can't cope with. Another of them is epidemic diseases, which I mentioned a couple of times already, often spread by these massive migrations, people bringing new kinds of germs and diseases into places where people have no defenses. A third of them is the collapse of states and governments, usually in huge wars, because they're just not able to cope with all these new forces. The fourth of them is famine, which regularly follows when governments collapse and people are not organizing markets effectively, food doesn't get moved around, people start to starve in enormous numbers. Then the fifth of them, which is always in the mix somewhere, is climate change, which we know quite a lot about now, about earlier episodes of climate change. And now all of these five factors, obviously you don't need me to tell you, that these are things that people are worrying about in enormous amounts in the early 21st century. And I think it's by no means impossible that we might be now reaching the verge of another of these great episodes of social collapse, which is a very terrifying prospect.
Let's jump back on the phone lines now at 1-800-933-5372. This time we have Kenneth on the line in Plano. Hello, Kenneth.
Yes, hi. As civilizations come and go, I'm curious to know, is our reaction to technology the same? I mean, if you think about it, we're still talking about Archimedes,
Mm-hmm.
We'll talk about Steve Jobs or Edison forever, Thank you very much.
Yeah, great question. Technology, of course, is a very big part of the story, and this is one of the things that fairly consistently, as societies get more developed, one of the outcomes of this is more and more sophisticated technology. And, I think there's a couple of interesting things about this story. One is that technology is rarely rolled back. Once something has been invented, it does sometimes happen that things get uninvented. But that is really unusual. The societies may collapse and the organization may wither, but the core technologies tend to survive these sorts of collapses. But the other thing which I thought is very striking in the history of technology is how innovations don't always get accepted. And there's often a tremendous amount of resistance to innovations. And people who have flourished under an older way of doing things are often very disturbed when new ways of doing things come in. And say, I guess a classic example would be something like book printing, where there's this huge army of monks out there copying out manuscripts or whatever, and now some guy shows up saying, hey, I can crank out 1,000 books in one day at a fraction of the cost. And there's a lot of resistance to this. And this is something we see over and over again around the world, people not wanting to accept the new ideas that are coming in. But it does seem like pretty much always, eventually, the new technologies do triumph, and people do open up and start working with the new ways.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we speak with Bill in Dallas. Hello, Bill.
Hello. A comment so much, not as much as a question. I think Dr. Morris is writing in more of a popular reductionist vein right now, which seems to be prominent. And I think that if geography and resources were all that mattered, then what doesn't matter is what people or a culture think, and I think that's extremely important. Also, I would like to challenge the idea that there was a rich Muslim core that was superior to the West, as Dr. Morris talked about earlier. I think largely Muslim culture, when it did reach its ascendancy, benefited largely from the Dahimis, the people that were conquered. But later, when Islamic rectitude took hold, the culture did regress. But much of the learning that came to Islam came through the conquered people, which were Western people.
Well, let's get some response to that. What do you think, Ian?
Yeah, well, I think These are both really good points. And the point about, you know, what people think and the role of culture in the story, this kind of runs through the whole book, because obviously if I wanting to claim that geography has been in the driving seat pushing things along, then the only way I can really demonstrate that is by showing that the individual decisions have mattered less than people have generally tended to think at the time. So a lot of the book is about this relationship. And I think it would be crazy to say, of course, that ideas don't matter, that individuals have no role in the story, because actual history is, of course, what individual people do. But one of the things that struck me very much writing the book was how often, if we think about, you know, what would have happened if somebody hadn't done this big famous thing, like if Edison hadn't had this great brainwave and this big new invention, what would have happened? And very often, when we've got enough evidence, we're able to see that, in fact, probably things would have turned out pretty much the same. That human beings are, you know, very similar animals taken in large groups. And that probably things would have proceeded down, you know, much the same path, even if that one particular individual hadn't come along. But obviously, you know, there's a huge room to argue over this, and historians will be arguing for a very long time. And with the second point you raise about, you know, the Muslim ascendancy, I think, yeah, you're absolutely right, of course. When the Arabs come into the old Byzantine Empire, they take over the whole tradition of Greek science going back for many centuries. You know, just as when the German peoples move into the western part of the Roman Empire, they do the same kind of thing. And then the medieval world that they create is very much built on the achievements of the Greeks and Romans before them. In the eastern part of the old Roman world, when the Arabs come in, initially, that's the richest part of the Roman world that they take over. And I think that's got a great deal to do with why it is for several centuries the biggest cities in the western end of Eurasia are all in the Muslim world, not in the Christian world. And Muslim traders are going further for many centuries, and you're being more inventive with the financial instruments and whatever that they come up with than the Christians are. But yeah, of course, and ultimately that starts to turn around. And part of it definitely is driven by the reaction that some Muslim rulers start to have, particularly after about 1600 or so, when they see these Christians out on the Atlantic coast tapping into this new economy there, becoming richer and richer. Some of the Muslim leaders start to say to themselves, boy, you know, we're falling behind. What can we do? And some of the Muslim leaders say we should try to copy what the Christians are doing, and learn to make the kind of guns and ships they're doing. But others say, no, we don't need to do that. We need to go back to our sacred books, because that's where the answers to our problems are likely to lie, which is a sort of reaction we see over and over again in history all around the world. So I think a lot of the decline of the Muslim world relative to the Christian world can be explained by these sorts of dynamics that we see over and over again through history.
So I only can give you about 15 seconds to answer this, but if the broad trajectories of technology and societies and wealth are not in our individual control, can we do anything to prepare ourselves for the way things will continue to change?
Yeah, I do think so. I think a lot of this depends on the question that you're asking. If your question is the Eastern world going to catch up with us? I think the answer is yes, mm-hmm. And that there's not a lot that Westerners can do about that. But on the other hand, if the question is, well, what is it going to be like for the West as the East catches up? That's something I think that Westerners can do a great deal about. There's a lot that can be done to shape how this process plays out.
Ian Morris is author of the book Why the West Rules for Now, The Patterns of History and What They Reveal About the Future. Ian, thank you so much for giving us this hour.
Well, thanks for having me on. It's been an absolute delight.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilufer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.